Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Chris Jackson. We're just talking about what we think might happen with autonomous vehicles in terms of how much they get used.
Well, you were talking about that these different models were the ownership of vehicles change. I don't have my vehicle parked in my parking spot. And it gets shared. It's more, I think in our last episode, you mentioned something about GM, which is likely going to sell this to rideshare organizations, which get way more miles per day than my vehicle sitting in my driveway right now.
That's right. And apparently the average driver spends 55 minutes behind the wheel, and that's the people who are driving cars. So
yeah, not in Southern California.
that's right. It's average, national right. Average.
There you go. Yeah, that's right.
And so, I mean, the zenith again is that one of the appeals of autonomous vehicles is that we'll be able to use what vehicles we have more efficiently. So if we say, let's just say that the average car is being driven for an hour every day, then the best we could hope for is 24 times that in terms of usage, if that represents efficiency. Mm-hmm. Obviously won't be that, but in terms of the actual usage we see on vehicles today, autonomous vehicles, if they're going to be used the way manufacturers say they're going to be used, will be going through so many more miles per year, and that might drive a whole new perspective of reliability for personal vehicles.
Oh yeah, there's precedent with that with taxi fleets. But before we dive into some of this and somehow it's going to change how the reliability of these vehicles behaves or performs, let's take a quick break.
Kirk Gray here. We want you to know that my company, Accelerated Reliability Solutions, is ready to support you with experienced leadership, guidance, and training to rapidly develop reliable, robust, and mature electronics at market introduction. To get started, go to accendoreliability.com/go/accelerated.
Right. Yeah. Now, Chris, I don't know if you had a chance to look up the specs or are familiar with the difference of just regular home-based fleets of vehicles versus taxi fleets.
No, I haven't. But yeah. Sorry, you keep going.
No, I'm trying to remember where I saw it, but it was the amount of my vehicle drives per year is, and for what I see most people are doing in this United States for personally owned vehicles, is on the order of 10 to 20,000 miles a year, where taxis are getting 100 to 300,000 miles a year. And they replace brakes, but the electric vehicles or hybrid vehicles like Priuses don't have much of brake problems. Those brakes and brake systems, because of the way they're engineered, just last way longer. But the engines last and perform better when they're used more often.
That's true.
Right? And so transmissions and all the big, heavy moving parts and I think the seat cushions and the dashboards take as much beating as any other vehicle out there. But if you're putting on 500,000 miles in a couple of years and then upgrading, the dashboard doesn't have time to degrade in the sun. You know, the paint doesn't have time to fade.
That's true. And perhaps instead of talking about changing gaskets or oil in the future, we might have to change seats.
That's right.
And because they're the things that wear out the most.
Yeah. And it's also, I think, part of this concept of these ride sharing programs run by a service, essentially, whether it's Uber or Lyft or something like that, it would come with the maintenance that there'd be professional maintenance strategies and structures on those things. And they could say, hey, this vehicle is due for an oil change. Tell it to come home versus a light in my dashboard today, which I ignore.
That's right. And one of my previous analyses I looked at is for military vehicles. I looked at the servicing schedules, and I found out that when I was doing the analysis, I looked at the failure rate of the vehicles post preventive maintenance or servicing. Mm-hmm. And what I found was that these vehicles are being chronically over-serviced because you have the front end of that bathtub curve. You always have maintenance-induced failures, so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. But these things are being serviced so often that we just keep reintroducing nothing but maintenance-induced failures. So counterintuitively, what we decided was that you service less often, and we are able to show that the vehicles became much more reliable as a result. Why I'm saying that is because
I'm laughing, Chris, because my first job in the Army as a private was a Jeep driver. And if I had nothing else to do, I had to change the oil or lubricate it or, you know, wash or do so. I was always doing something according to some checklist every day.
Well, I can statistically show for you that you're probably reducing the reliability of that vehicle when you're doing it, unfortunately, and not your fault.
Well, I wasn't, you know, I was a private in the Army. It was the first time I used a manual transmission. I had no idea what I was doing. I'm being asked to go set the timing by adjusting the location of the distributor cap. I had no idea. They gave me a strobe gun to flash it on the timing belt. I had no idea what I was doing, you know, and the guy next to me says, well, just adjust it to it sounds good. I'm like, okay, what's that?
Hopefully they got better.
Well, not really. I was, I totally agree, especially with military vehicles. Absolutely. Yeah.
The point is that if you're servicing a vehicle, you are taking, or any system, you are taking a system that up until that point was working. It's not there because it's failed. It was mm-hmm. working.
Right.
So if you are not, if that thing doesn't need to be serviced, then the only thing you can do is make it worse. There is no scope to make it better. If it doesn't need to be serviced, if the oil that you're supposed to be changing out doesn't need to be changed, then by definition, the only thing that can happen is you might break it. So you only benefit from servicing if you're going to service when it needs to be serviced. So why I'm talking about this is because now manufacturers have more skin in the game if in this autonomous vehicle future we think is going to happen. Gone are the days where they can just vomit out servicing schedules and the consumer needs to eat it. They can say it needs to be serviced every 6 months, 12 months, so on and so forth.
Yeah.
They don't care because the customer, the consumer, has to pay for that. Now, if manufacturers are going to be more tightly linked to ride-sharing services, every time that vehicle is off the road, the manufacturer, the design team, wears that cost. So I'll also be amazed if we don't see servicing schedules get really forensically examined in ways that haven't been examined before, because now they are essentially liable for overprescription in terms of servicing.
Well, there's two thoughts here, Chris. One is I know with the newer, especially the electric vehicles, are coming with way more telemetry. And mm-hmm. and there's folks around the world that are struggling with just how do you deal with all that data? Are we collecting the right stuff? Are, you know, monitoring all that? The whole concept of prognostic health management and all of those aspects of what we do as reliability professionals, the amount of information and data now is going to become very, very valuable to companies running these fleets. On the other hand, I've been in some taxis that hadn't seen shock absorbers that were functional for decades, you know, if I use it more often, especially on rough roads and potholed city roads and stuff like that, there are some things that do wear out much, much quicker. Yet if the standard is the existing taxi fleet, we're going to have some pretty rough rides in these vehicles. They might get us where we want to go, but it won't be comfortable.
Well, that's, and this is where people need to get creative when they think about the future. So, for example, if we have just a purely ride sharing transportation future in front of us, mm-hmm. we'll have, and we're talking about class 4 autonomous or automation. We're not talking about class 5. Barely, no one's really talking about class 5, which is essentially.
What's the difference between 4 and 5? You lost me there.
The difference primarily is that class 5, there are no restrictions or no imposed restrictions on where these vehicles can go. But realistically, manufacturers are talking about class 4. We're going to create an autonomous vehicle, but it's designed to only go in downtown cities, for example. There's no lunar buggies going to be produced. And the reason why is because when you say, I want to go from here to here, the ride-sharing platform will know what the nature of that road is and say, oh, okay, you just need to have this relatively low duty vehicle to get from here to there because the roads are very, very good. But if you're going to go, if you're going to go over a very, if it's cross country terrain, then again, the ride sharing platform will be able to say, oh, now you need to have a dune buggy autonomous vehicle. So as opposed to having the very human idea, I need to have a vehicle which can be driven on virtually any road in the United States or the world more broadly, now we actually can get away with having vehicles tailored to very specific driving situations.
Well, yeah, I agree with that. Yet I'm thinking of the number of taxis I've gotten into around the world. And if the vehicle does its primary function, carries the luggage and passenger from point A to point B, the heater, the radio, the seat warmers, the suspension system, all don't really have to work all that well. And there's plenty of potholes in San Francisco.
Yeah, absolutely.
In other parts of the world that a dune buggy would probably be the right vehicle to survive there. And they change dynamically just because it's on a map one day. There could be a huge hole there tomorrow. So I'm curious of how it's going to pan out. And if we have good, healthy competition, a couple of different ride services, they may target different quality of ride instances and arrival times and those kinds of factors that me as a consumer would say, if I call a vehicle and I have a only needs a 5-minute heads up, because if I go shopping and if it takes me longer or shorter, I don't want to make up the difference on waiting for a vehicle to show up. I'm in the checkout line. I swipe my card and I pay, and at the same time it calls the car because it knows I'm going to be outside in 3 minutes. Right. Whereas if it's a 30-minute lead time, then it's less tenable. But if the service has given me a comfortable, clean car that rides well and gets me from point A to point B, that's part of the maintenance of the vehicle. And it's different than just it being safely transporting this mass from A to B.
And I think that the industry is going to rise to that challenge. We're going to look, think of an airport. There are taxis just waiting there because they know that's where people need to get into a taxi to go from A to B.
Right.
So when these manufacturers or these ride sharing companies start going big scale, they'll know exactly where the likely passenger needs going to be.
Well, the traffic patterns, it tends to be pretty consistent unless there's a really good sale on the Super Bowl commercial or something and everybody runs off to somewhere. There is actually a science fiction story. What if that law of averages of, queuing to go buy bobbins for, for your sewing machine wasn't just one or two people a day in a city would go get those? What if everybody in town wanted those on the same day? So there's some, anyway, that's a sidetrack. There's a whole bunch of what ifs if the statistics doesn't work anymore, but you're right. And I saw that when I did some work on the Microsoft campus a number of years ago, and it was a ride sharing system. They had vehicles being driven around in vans, small vans, and you would go to the receptionist and say, hey, there's three of us. We need to go to building 82. And a few minutes, usually within 2-3 minutes, a vehicle would show up saying, hey, I'm taking you to building 82. And we'd get in and go. And then he would pull up his next destination. And if it was somebody at Building 82 that was going somewhere that was perfect, if it was somebody at Building 81, you'd drive over there and you'd be 2 minutes away. But it was a pretty cool system, and it kept those cars running all day long. And then they would stage cars, you know, where they knew there was going to be demand. If they knew they just dropped off 100 people at some auditorium, and they would ask, how long is this meeting going? And they'd have a whole fleet of cars sitting out there 2 hours later. Yeah, it was pretty slick how they did it. But now you automate it, right? And you watch the data, right? What I'm concerned about is that we're going to be generating all this data, and they can fine-tune with a profit motive the maintenance of that. So in Chicago in the winter, do you think the heater's going to work?
Well, I sense that the pricing model from a customer's perspective will be a lot like mobile phones. I mean, you can purchase a handset outright, or you can purchase a contract. Mm-hmm. But if we, and same with many other service subscriptions, we're going to stop thinking about these vehicles as an asset that the family owns. It's going to be a part of a service that's being provided, and it truly will. So we're clearly going to have the ride-sharing industry. So we're clearly going to have autonomous vehicles in the ride-sharing industry. I think we'll clearly have autonomous vehicles as personal vehicles as well, at least, you know, initially. And I think that consumer sentiment will win out. You know, there might be a very natural fraction of vehicles which are owned by the consumer versus owned by a ride-sharing service, and I think that will the sheer volume of the market will make both forms of autonomous vehicle profitable. That is be different.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm really curious how, because this is more than just how do I get to work or how do I get to the airport, or, you know, it's it's beyond just the ride-share impact on taxi services. It's car dealerships change. A gas station on every corner changes. A whole bunch of infrastructure stuff that's going to impact a huge number of industries. It's going to change. The secondary industry of tricking out your car and you know, putting your fins on it or tinted windows or, you know, fuzzy dice or whatever. I remember when vehicles came out with that you could program the seat to certain adjustments, and you could, and if I used my key fob on it, the seat would automatically go to my settings, where if my wife used her key fob on it, it would go to her settings and or something like that. It was a way to have it remember your favorite settings. I don't know that vehicles still have that feature anymore or not, but if I could say I need a car, I want a car to go to the airport, and it plays the music I like, it has my connection to my servers for my email and everything else is available on the screen. You know, if the service comes with it's customized to me when I walk into it, I don't have to set it up every time I get into it. That would be way cool.
Yeah. And yeah, I think that's more than reasonable in terms of expectations of future autonomous vehicles. And if you don't like, you know, if you don't like your carrier for your cell phone, you go to another carrier as well. So there'll be that natural.
You know, they're not that different. You know, there's five of them or so in the US, and the pricing's all reasonably comparable. The service is different in different parts of the country. And I talked to some realtors over the last couple of years because I found myself when we go out looking at different houses routinely, mostly just to see how other people decorate their house and get ideas and snoopy. But I always check my phone to see what kind of service they get. It's become a criteria. I won't buy a house unless it has good cell service. Where if I have a rideshare program and if I buy in that service, what I found though with AT&T and Verizon is they both kind of do this race to the bottom. They're trying to get as much profit per subscription as they can. So they're not offering the bells and whistles. They're not upgrading as fast as they could. We go to overseas and we get great service on these systems, where the US system I don't know why, but we just don't get it. We don't get the high speed internet to the house like they are in Japan and other countries. So I'm worried about it, Chris, because of that same patterns playing out in vehicles. I wish it wouldn't happen, and I wish it would be much more a virtuous competition that we get great service. But I don't think so.
And I don't know what the answer is, but let's look at history. When the Japanese car started hitting the US marketplace in the early 80s, everyone was astounded by how reliable they were. Mm-hmm. And to be fair, the rest of the industry started to step up. They saw what
still
could
playing
be done.
Catch up. Yeah.
Still playing catch up.
Yeah.
But Honda, for example, is one of the yardsticks of reliability. People, mm-hmm. and for good reason. So perhaps in the future, where with these autonomous vehicles clearly won't be manufactured with a single country in mind, it might be a little bit more difficult to have that sort of anti-competition race at the bottom that you're talking about. But again, it's going to be difficult. We'll have to wait and see.
Yeah. And then pursue it. It's, if somebody gives you the distinct advantage, or it's a safer, quieter, more comfortable, customized ride, then you got to vote with your dollars. If everybody just wants a box that has a bench in it and gets us from A to B at the absolute cheapest price, then it won't have a radio.
Yeah.
That's
right.
And I think it'll pan out one way or the other, or maybe a mix of those different models. And then again, was it Yogi Berra said something about it's really difficult to make predictions, especially about the future.
That's right. That's true. And those, we talked about those red flag traffic laws, which just show that. But and I think, we've discussed previously, at least from my perspective, how regulators and academia and issue motivated groups and think tanks and what have you, everyone who's not a manufacturer has not been advancing the conversation in regards to how these things are going to impact society for the last decade. Mm-hmm. Manufacturers have. And I think it's a failing on that sort of non-manufacturer side of the industry, to be sure. But it also belies the fact it's very difficult to predict the future. And especially when you have when these organizations tend to have super conservative, overly process centric people, mm-hmm. who, unless it's demonstrated to 10 nines, they won't sign off on it. And so you'll never get anything to happen because
it takes
that conservative mindset.
Yeah, it takes like the GM announcement we talked about in the last episode, where one way to invent the future is to just go do it. And I'm sure it's going to change. The models will develop and evolve, and the first one out is likely not to be the right one. It's often the fast follower that reaps the benefits. So it's going to be whoever's next after them. But somebody's got to start, and somebody's going to learn a whole ton. And if they can make it all work, that'd be awesome. But I agree. I think they're coming, and it's going to be a change. The way we drive and vehicle ownership, all that stuff's going to change. So let's hand it off to our listeners. How's your crystal ball? What do you think? Chris and I have got a couple of opinions on these, and I think there are going to be a number of forces and dynamics that are going to be a surprise to the industry, and some will be as expected. Although I'm still waiting for the Jetsons little airships to flit us from one space to another through air. But even in the Jetsons, Chris, those were not—they were autonomous vehicles, but they were privately owned. They each
That's
had their
true.
Own vehicle, so they didn't foresee that.
Shame
on them. So. But it's coming. I fully agree it's coming, and it's going to make some changes. It's going to be exciting. And it's like in the next 2-3 years. So it's
happening, it's right there. So if you're not already part of the conversation, it's probably too late.
That's right. Well, a great way to be part of the conversation is go over to reliability.fm, and you can find this episode under the Speaking of Reliability series. There's other shows that deal with different aspects of reliability and reliability engineering, and there's opportunity to leave comments and to leave, join the discussion. Send us an email. Get a hold of us via LinkedIn, whatever works for you. Send over your autonomous delivery drone and leave us a book, whatever works for you. But join the conversation. We'd love to hear from you. It often makes the fodder for upcoming episodes. So please don't be shy and let us know what you think about this discussion on autonomous vehicles and what's your take on it, or other aspects of reliability and reliability engineering that's on your mind. We'd love to hear from you. So with that, Chris, I think we'll wrap this one up.
Thank you, Fred.
All right. Talk to you later, Chris. Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.